Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Kent Hariff, who has four novels. The two most recent are Plain Song and Eventide. Kent Hariff writes about a county called Holt, Colorado. When you first began writing your novels, The Tie That Binds, and set it in Holt, did you know that this would become the place where all your novels were set?
No, I had no idea of that. And in fact, I didn't know if I'd ever write another novel, but I guess I feel as if I'm stuck in Holt for good reasons, I guess. It suits my purposes. The stories I want to tell, I think I can tell there, although I don't think of myself as being a regional writer or someone who writes exclusively about small towns and country life. I want to think that the stories I write have something to do with fundamental human problems anywhere.
You say that you grew up a preacher's son and lived most of your formative years in those high plains. Now, you grew up in Colorado, right?
That's right.
Then you have a very, very long list of jobs. You served in the Peace Corps in Turkey at one point?
I did. I was there in the middle 60s. I was teaching English in a little middle school out in a village on the Anatolian Plateau, far away from any urban area.
Not quite like Holt, Colorado.
Well, it is. It is in some ways. It was about the same size of towns, yeah.
And then you came back. You were a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And during that time you served?
Well, as you know, I'm sure you need to serve 2 years in lieu of military service. So I worked in a rehabilitation hospital for a while, and then I was a house parent in an orphanage, and I also worked as a surgery orderly. So I did my time that way.
Let me ask you this before we move on to your work. The U.S. is currently engaged in a war in Iraq. You were a conscientious objector concerning Vietnam. What do you see as the parallels between the two?
Well, I see it as an absolute disaster. Our being in a foreign place that we had no business being in, have no business being there now, I think. I think we do not have the slightest idea what Muslim culture is about. I think particularly our administration, I think they're absolutely ignorant about that.
So your views in some ways have not changed that much?
They haven't changed in that regard, no. I can't think that killing people is an answer to anything.
It's interesting that you've been compared to Tobias Wolff, who went to Vietnam and wrote about it, and your views are very similar.
Mm-hmm. And I should say, I take no credit for being a CO. I have a great deal of admiration for men who did go through that experience, and some of my best friends who served over there are the most adamant anti-war people I know, and Wolf is one of them.
After you did your service as a conscientious objector, you applied to the University of Iowa Workshop and at that point was rejected.
Right. I had written some very feeble, amateurish, imitative stories while I was in the Peace Corps. That's when I began to try to write stories, and rightly so. Iowa rejected me, and then I kept on trying to write, and later on they did accept me. But it was felt sort of as if they accepted me on probation. I was pretty desperate to get in there, and I moved out there in the middle of winter and brought my wife and daughter out there and told them I was there and kept sending them stories, and finally I did hear that they were going to let me in, and I think it's fair to say, I guess, that I made some progress that first year and got a fellowship the second year, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. That's all I did know I wanted to do.
Was it a problem of finding your voice or a problem of finding the right way to write?
All of that. I was a rank amateur. I was just beginning to learn my craft, and I felt I needed some kind of formal training, and it was a good time for me. People taught writing very differently back then than they do now. They were pretty much hands-off. He would say, this works or this doesn't, and that was about it. Now we get in and mess around in people's manuscripts and become prescriptive in ways that they never did back then.
Is that a good thing, you think, or not?
I'm not so sure. I think sometimes we get in the students' manuscripts too much. Instead of let them sort of mess around with their own problems, I think we probably interfere too much.
While you were learning how to write, you did other jobs. You built grain bins, steel buildings, taught at an alternative high school in Madison, Wisconsin.
I was in the 70s, interesting time to be in Madison. The war was still on there. Of course, Madison, like places like Berkeley, were very radical back in those days, and it was an exciting time to be there. The alternative high school I taught in at that time was primarily a place where kids with drug problems went.
1978, you move back to Colorado and you become an English teacher. Did some of your work as an English teacher there or in Madison inform the character of Tom Guthrie?
Yeah, it had to. Tom Guthrie is an English teacher, as a history teacher in the novel Plainsong, and much of what I know about teaching, of course, gets into that portrayal of him, and also of Maggie Jones, who's also a teacher in that school. Tom Guthrie gets in a fist fight with one of the students. That never happened to me, although I have broken up fights in schools. But some of the experience that he undergoes happened to me.
The experience he undergoes in Plainsong involving one particular boy whose parents appeal to the school board and everyone in existence to try to get this guy to pass a class that he doesn't deserve to pass. Did that happen?
No, I never had that kind of pressure, but I did see a lot of parents who were very upset with what was going on to their kid in school, and sometimes rightly so and sometimes not. And I did see and was involved in a number of kind of heated discussions between parents and faculty and administration.
And all this time you were learning how to write, and your first novel came out 84.
And the second novel came out in 1990.
And the first novel, The Tie That Binds, is first person, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And the second novel, while it got good reviews, you were not very happy with it at all.
No, I felt under tremendous pressure to get that book done, and I probably wrote it faster than I should have. That's not a good excuse. It's no excuse, really. It was shorter than it should have been. It should have probably been another 100 pages in length.
Do any of the characters from those two books, Tie That Binds and Where You Once Belonged, appear in Plainsong?
No.
No?
With the exception, I guess, of the sheriff, Bud Seeley. He's the only character that appears in those three novels.
Plainsong represents a huge leap. It's an extraordinary book. Were you aware, as you were working on it, that your style had finally matured?
No, I knew that the style was different and that I was quite conscious of what I was trying to do there. The other part of that, and that had some bearing on the style of that novel, is that I was trying to write a book almost entirely in scene. There's very little narration in that book. So that helped determine the kind of direct, simplified prose that I was trying to work on.
Now, according to what I read about you, you wrote that book, the first draft, by putting a wool stocking over your head and just writing longhand? Is that correct?
Well, that's not quite. It's close, but it's not okay. Quite exactly right. The story behind that is that I had written the second novel on the computer, and I never felt right about that. I missed the sound of keys. I missed the paper. The other part of that is when you write on a computer, it seems to me that you can write the same sentence endlessly and lose some parts of that or some drafts of that that you may later want to go back to. So when it came time to write Plainsong, I wanted to go back to something that I'd done earlier, and that is to write on a manual typewriter and to use an old kind of yellow paper that I'm fond of. And to get away from being blocked by attention to syntax or diction or punctuation or spelling, any of those kinds of things, and to force myself to move on, to get done with that sentence, I did put a stocking cap over my head and did shut my eyes and write the first draft of every scene, not the whole book all at once, but just a draft of each scene blindfolded. In a sense, I was trying to blind myself so I could see. That seemed to work all right.
So you just sat there at the typewriter and and eventually the platen would hit.
That's right. And I'm a pretty good typist, and I think only once did I ever type past the bottom of the page, and only once did I get off the home row and type nonsense.
How did you come up with that idea, and what was that first page like?
Well, first of all, I typed it in single space, so I could get the whole scene on one page, and of course it was a smaller version than what eventually I did end up with. After I had finished that, then I went back and reworked that page for the next 2 weeks on a computer. But what I was trying to do was to keep what was spontaneous and natural about that first draft and not overwork it.
So you couldn't go back and see what you'd done and say, uh-oh, and you completely shut down your critical mind.
I did. That's exactly right. That's a good insight. I was trying to shut down that analytical part of your mind too soon, before you're ready for it, before you stop yourself.
Now, the style of Plainsong Well, the definition of plain song is a simple and unadorned melody or air, and in a way, that's the style of both plain song and Eventide.
Right.
Very clean, very, very clean. Did you find yourself working to clean it up that way?
Yeah, it is, and I've been coming to that direction all along. Of course, I read Hemingway very carefully, for I still do. I mean, he's a writer that I've admired since I was an undergraduate, and I don't think my prose is like Hemingway's exactly, but I do admire that eye that he has and the ear he has and that refusal to write anything that seems gorgeous or ego-driven. It's my contention that if you can write simply and directly and clearly and cleanly and make it work, if you do it well enough, it's very easy to write badly doing that too.
One advantage, I guess, is you wind up with a page-turning literary novel, which is quite rare.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, that's my effort, my intention. As all the imitators of Hemingway have shown, you can do that in ways that don't work at all.
In both novels, you do not use quotation marks. Why?
Well, that's a sort of idiosyncratic. It's not a theoretical defense, but it's my defense. I like it the way it looks on the page. I like it seems uncluttered. It seems cleaner. It seems more direct. Also, it seems to me there's a kind of tension in the page without that kind of convention being present. It is a convention. It seems to me that you can break that convention if you can do it without confusing your reader. If I've confused you as a reader, then that's a mistake. And I'm not the only one doing this. I don't claim to be. I first saw it in Faulkner when I was an undergraduate in such stories as The Bear or The Sound and the Fury. But Cormac McCarthy doesn't use quotation marks. Raymond Carver wrote some stories without quotation marks. A lot of people have done that.
You also use a lot of pronouns rather than the names of the people, and frequently don't worry if a sentence winds up being a run-on.
Yeah, that's true, and both of those are probably influences from Faulkner. Faulkner does that repeatedly, and you're not always sure, unless you're paying very close attention, who he's talking about. Of course, he's famous and infamous for writing very long sentences.
Very long sentences.
Yeah, one of his sentences is, six or seven pages long in The Bear.
Well, this is rather counter to your work, in which even the run-on sentences are relatively brief.
They are, compared to Faulkner.
Well, let's talk about the content of these two novels, because Eventide, in a way, I don't want to call it a sequel. It's more a continuation of events and characters, because new characters come in, and Plain Song sits by itself. And if you didn't read Plain Song, Eventide sits by itself as well.
Well, I hope so, and that was one of my efforts to try to make sure that was possible for a reader to start with this new book if he or she wanted to. I suppose it's splitting here, but I don't call it a sequel because I began to write this book before I ever finished Plain Song. I knew that I had more to say about the McFerrin brothers, and I knew essentially what was going to happen to them and how their lives were going to play out. So I began to make notes to myself. So I think of it in my own terms as a kind of one long continuous story.
You've said that the characters of Harold and Raymond McFerrin, that you knew these people at one time, or people similar to that. Were they brothers?
When I was a kid out in eastern Colorado, there were a couple old bachelor ranchers who came into my father's church every Sunday morning in their black suits and white shirts, and I never heard them say anything. I didn't really know anything about them, but I just knew that they were brothers who lived out in the country. And my younger brother and I thought that was an ideal way to live. But that condition, not that I knew them at all, but that condition, the idea of two brothers living alone out in the country, I suppose was something that rattled around in my brain for almost 50 years.
Toward the beginning of Plain Song, Tom Guthrie's two sons make a couple of trips out there and do some work. Did that happen, or was that just a fantasy you wish had happened?
That never happened to me when I was a kid, but I have worked on ranches as an adult, and my older brother had a ranch for some time.
Into their lives comes Victoria Robidoux, who is a half-Indian girl who has been thrown out by her mother, and it's a juxtaposition of a young contemporary girl with these two old characters. At what point did you decide that would work? Was that kind of the binding element that caused the book to happen?
It was sort of, and again, I appreciate your recognizing that. It is the most unusual aspect of that book. In many ways, it's an improbable situation. Here's this pregnant teenage girl, and she ends up, because of peculiar circumstances, living with two old bachelor ranchers. That doesn't ordinarily happen, but I wanted to believe that could happen, but I also was very interested in how these three people would relate to one another and what changes they would have to go through in order to make that work. It seems to me that she needs a home and someone to take her in and give her some kind of sanctuary, but they certainly need to have their lives expanded too. And so there's a mutual, there's a need on both sides of this equation.
You're listening to an interview with Kent Haroff, whose latest novel is Eventide. What you do is you weave, in both of these books, you weave several stories together. In this one, you weave the story of Tom Guthrie, the story of the McFerrin brothers, and bits and pieces of other tales as well, Guthrie's sons.
Right.
In the second one, you weave the continuing story. That story continues, which we'll get to in a moment, as well as the story of a kid and his grandfather and a family where one of the characters is an abuser.
Mm-hmm.
When you were working on that, okay, when you were molding it, when you got the first draft, how instinctive is it to make sure that you don't focus too much on any given story and that the flow works?
Before I ever write anything, first of all, I know the ending of a story, and I make myself some very brief notes about what's going to happen to each of these kids, these people, these adults, and try to figure out ways to dramatically deliver their story, to make scenes out of their story, and also to make scenes that seem to rise in intensity so that you end up with the most dramatic moments at the end of the book. You don't want the book to break down in half because it's the most dramatic thing happens then. And then simply also to, well, not simply is probably not the right word, but also to try to make these things happen simultaneously. So all of that took some thinking about a plot, but these books are all character-driven, and then the plot comes out of their character.
When you know this in the back of your mind, how do you keep that down even with a wool stocking over your head?
Well, I've thought about this story, as I say, for at least a year before I ever write anything. I brood over the story. And I also, as I've already said, make a few notes. I have a very sketchy outline of what's going on.
Right.
So that plot, the storyline, is set before I ever write anything.
Do you do research?
I did a little bit for this book. I almost never do, but this book needed that. I've talked to social workers, people in social services, a number of times in order to get that part of the story right. I talked to lawyers and a public defender in Colorado to make sure I got the legal stuff right in this book. So those two parts of this book, I did do some research for. In the case of Plainsong, you were talking about that a moment ago, the pregnant girl does go to a doctor to be examined, and I persuaded my wife to allow me to go with her for one of her GYN appointments and sat there and took notes and watched everything and grilled the doctor afterwards. So I've done a little bit of research just to make sure I know what I'm talking about.
One of the elements of writing plainly and clearly is trying to keep moral judgments out of your writing. That must be very difficult, particularly when you hit the character of Hoyt the abuser.
That's right. My effort is to not give authorial judgments. I mean, I suppose one is implied by what's given in the story, but I don't do what some writers have done in this kind of metafiction way. I'm still, I suppose, old-fashioned in that regard, that I want to keep these stories separate from any of intrusion on my part, to simply present these stories and to show these people as clearly as I can by what they say and what they do, and let the reader make what he or she will of that.
And that would apply to, I mean, if you saw something that looked in the least bit condescending, you'd have to work on that as well.
Well, that's true, and especially in the case of the Wallace family,
right.
Luther and Betty. They are handicapped mentally, and they do receive disability checks. And the last thing I wanted to do with them was to imply any kind of judgment on them or suggest some kind of romanticization or sentimentalizing or any of those things. I simply wanted to present them as clearly as I could.
One of the main changes between Eventide and Plainsong, and it happens fairly early in Eventide, is the death of Harold. Had that been planned?
That's the part of the story that when I was saying that I knew what was going to happen.
You knew that would happen. Yeah.
Before I finished Plainsong, I knew he was going to die violently. I didn't know exactly how, but I knew it had to do something to do with ranch work. Ranchers and farmers are often hurt by accidents. Accidents are very common in rural America.
Why Harold rather than Raymond?
Well, he's older. He's the gruffer of the two. Raymond seems to me more tender and more emotional. He's the one in Plainsong, for example, who makes sure that Victoria's all right when she comes back. So I suppose intuitively I thought, well, he would be the one that might be able to cope with the absence of the other brother. And that's his challenge, is to try to figure out how to live without someone he's loved and lived with for, 60, 70 years.
One thing I noticed in the two books, because trying to pin it down, is outside of the character of Victoria and the children, you stay very, very far away from specifically naming ages.
That's true. And people have asked me how old the McVeran brothers are. Well, I'd never say, but in my mind and my conception of them, in this new book, they are, 70 and 72, something like that. The character Rose Tyler, I describe her as being middle-aged. Well, what does that mean? In this connection, I think of her as in her early 50s or middle 50s, something like that.
The impression I got was that you stayed away from it because you didn't want us to focus in that way.
Well, I don't want to, and that seems arbitrary. Of course, I do give the ages or at least the grades that the kids are in because you need that kind of information. But I want to I'm in specific also in regard to when this story is set. I give some internal dating, but those things are fairly brief. In this new book, I mentioned Walmart. In the previous book, I mentioned Nancy Reagan. Those kinds of details can date a book. But these stories are sort of outside of time. There's no mention of cell phones or computers, that sort of stuff.
And there's no mention whatsoever in either book of politics.
No, they're not. There's nothing to do with religion or politics, any of that. These people are, I think of them as fundamental people, as elemental people, and perhaps universal for that reason, I hope. I'm simply trying to tell a story about the human condition. I don't want to confuse that by politics. Obviously, politics are very important in all kinds of ways, but not in what I'm trying to do in these stories.
Do you ever feel frustrated about that?
No, I don't. It liberates me from saying that this story happened in, 1968 or something. They don't. In my view, they happened close to the end of the 1980s, early 1990s. But once you date a story, once you refer to political things, then you're obliged to abide by historical facts. And that I don't want to do.
Well, Kent Harif, it's obvious that you have very, very strong political views, and you cannot bring them out in your books. And most authors, the views surface on some level. These they don't.
No, I don't think they do. I think I can only repeat what I've already said. My effort is to say something about
the human condition.
The human condition, which I hope is universal and elemental.
Why do you go in that direction?
Now, that's what I'm interested in. That's the kind of fiction that I want to write. On the other hand, if somebody from this state, Steinbeck wrote a wonderfully powerful novel, and think of novels like Darkness at Noon by Kessler and things like that. Those are wonderful books, but that's not my bent. I do have, as you suggest, strong political views, but that's not what I'm up to when I'm working at fiction.
If I would come up with a writer who remind me of it, might be Carver.
Well, thank you. I would never compare myself to Raymond Carver, but he certainly was a writer that I admired, and he was absolutely influential in the 1980s in this country in terms of people who were trying to write fiction. And of course, he comes from here on the West Coast, and as it turns out, his editor and mine are the same man, Gary Fiskejohn, and Gary knew and was one of Carver's very best friends.
Kent Harif, what do you know about Hult that you're not talking about?
Well, I know a lot about religion in small towns that I have not written about. I may someday. As you suggested earlier, I think I am a preacher's kid. My father was a Methodist preacher, and I grew up seeing what happened every Sunday in the Methodist church. So I may come back to that someday.
Are you planning to continue the characters from this in another book?
I don't plan to. I don't see myself writing anything continuing of this story. Well, but people have suggested I should, but I don't see myself doing that. I want to make some changes in format and that stuff. I feel as I've done these two books recently in more or less the same format. So I need to change and learn how to do some other things.
When you say the same format?
Third person is following this group of people around in each book, this kind of distilled, simplified prose. I don't think the prose was changed so much, but I know I want to maybe think about following one or two people around next time and make it a continuous story rather than one that is broken up into these individual chapters the way this one is.
The focus of these books is almost like the focus of a short story. Have you written any short stories recently?
I did. I wrote some earlier, and I hope to write a few more, but it seems to me that the stories that I conceive that come to me come in book length.
Is it my imagination or was Plain Song recently a made-for-TV movie?
It was, and in my view, it was a very bad one. It was not a movie that I cared for at all. The most egregious thing they did, I think, was to make buffoons of the old man, who I think are noble and have great integrity. But in the film, I didn't think it worked at all the way they portrayed them.
Did you have anything to do with the film at all?
I had nothing to do with it. I sold the contract. I did send a memo to somebody at Hallmark saying what I hoped they wouldn't do to the story, and they did manage to do most of those things.
Isn't it unavoidable in a way when you're dealing with television and they're trying to basically not merely show, but show and tell?
Yeah, and of course they knew what their audience was. They didn't want to offend anybody. They were going to be very careful about that. It seemed to me that they made the movie bland and took away whatever sting it might have had, that story.
When I spoke with Ethan Kanan, who's a mainstay of the University of Iowa workshop,
yeah,
he talked a lot about voice. I interviewed E.L. Doctorow, and he gave a good definition of voice, which is an examination of both syntax and characterization combined.
Mm.
Do you think in terms of voice?
I do, in a number of ways. Certainly you think of it that way in regard to dialogue and how people sound in dialogue and their voices. But also, yeah, the thing that you mess around with and continually try to hone is the sound of the prose, and I think that is voice. The tone, diction, all the word choices, all of those things go into voice. The first two books were first-person books, and, of course, voice is extremely important in that, and because you're characterizing somebody by the way he tells a story or she tells a story. In these cases, in third person, even then, you're very careful about the kind of prose that you end up with. That's the effort that you make continuously. I write each sentence over and over in each paragraph over and over in each chapter, and then I'm done with it. But in this case, I had my wife read this book aloud to me as we were driving out here to California for a reading. And the more she read, the more distressed I got. By the time we got to the hotel, I was in despair. And so I began to rewrite the book immediately, not because of character or because of storyline, but because the prose was wrong and essentially the voice was wrong. The sound was wrong. So over the next several months, then I rewrote the book entirely, simply because the sound of it was wrong.
Which is far different from Doctorow said he can't even get into a book unless he has the voice down.
Well, that's ordinarily my case, and I usually have a paragraph or two that serve as touchstones for me, and I sort of go back to them. But in this case, I don't know, I had fooled myself, I guess, in thinking that I had the voice right, but it wasn't right.
Are you satisfied now?
Well, as much as you ever are. You're never pleased with it entirely. There are always things that you would like to fix, and it never matches the idea or the dream you have of it.
You always know the ending, you always know the beginning, but the middle is always different?
I know the middle, too, except that there are some things that I don't know and that they're not surprises to me. But what is discovered along the way are some of the details and occasionally some minor characters I had no notion of. But those are the only real surprises to me along the way. Of course, you're still trying to do as well as you can.
You say discover. It's already there?
Well, that's a good point. It's there in some sense because the story needs it to be there. You mentioned the character, for example, of DJ, the little boy who's been orphaned. His mother has died. He never knew his father. So he lives with his grandfather, who probably doesn't want him all that much. What I discovered as I began to write about him, that he needed more in his story. There wasn't enough there. So what he needed was someone to complicate his life or to enlarge it. And what the narrative need, therefore, caused the invention of Mary Wells and her two little girls who were neighbors of his. They become a fairly significant part of the story. But again, that's simply out of narrative necessity.
You've been listening to an interview with Kent Hariff, whose most recent novel is Eventide. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.